Hello and welcome to episode 107 of Speak Beastie for February 23rd, 2020. I'm Amy.
I'm Oreo.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Marjolaine.
Hello, guys.
Hi.
I don't know if I've ever recorded with Ario and Marjo.
I don't think I've recorded with either you and Lizzie, so...
It's a treat.
Yeah, first time.
Yeah. Yay!
We also have another co-host. Surprise, guys. It's my cat. Hopefully she behaves.
Hello, Lizzie's cat.
We had a stare down while we were syncing up our audio, and I was like, don't do it. But now she's on the couch, so let's hope behaves the rest of this time. Take your teddy bear, go lay down. Thank you. Okay.
My cat has just entered the room too, so we'll see. Hopefully she doesn't knock anything over.
My cat yesterday knocked over a bowl of potatoes.
Oh, nice.
I was very mad. And she knew it. And then she sat in timeout, and she did not like it. And this has been parenting with Lizzie.
Oh, girls, I realized something looking on the date. I think if I'm projecting myself into the future, and I'm currently in the future on a convention on this day of the release of the episode.
Oh,
nice.
Where will you be?
I will be in Yggdrasil Festival in Lyon. And yeah, it's a festival all about fantasy and I will be with La Gazette du Sorcier, the French fan site. And the day we record, I realized that I will doing a conference about theory in fantasy beasts, so yeah.
We are wishing you luck into the future.
And I will be wearing my Speak Beastie t-shirt, so
yeah.
If you are on the social media of the Speak Beastie today, I guess maybe some photo will appear.
Speaking for the future.
Yeah. I hope it will be, everything will go okay, because it would be weird if for any reason I'm not there.
We love our time traveling on this show.
Shall we jump into the news?
Yes. We do we have news?
Yes.
That is a shock to me, to be honest.
Well, something major will probably happen right after we record this, because
obviously. That's the trend.
And now for the Phoenix Register.
And now a message from our sponsors.
Hey you! Yes you! The magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind the scenes features. But wait, there's more! Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wiggs knees and how.
So first thing that we have is that thanks to Marjolaine, we know that filming will have started around the time that this episode comes out. Ooh. So, again, we're jumping into the future here, but exciting nonetheless. Marjolaine, do you want to touch on it a little bit?
Yeah, so actually, this weekend, the weekend that we released this episode, there is Comic-Con Brussels, and Dan Fogler was supposed to be there, but then he had to cancel because, and I quote, "the schedule of Fantasy Beasts 3 has been changed." So, yeah, that's the only official announcement, but we can guess that maybe he is on set or at least at a table reading or something like that. But he can't be in Brussels, so...
I feel like, didn't Dan, like, spill the beans that the script was finished, too? Like, I feel like he just, like, makes these announcements assuming that it's public knowledge.
Yeah, he mentioned something like, oh, I'm pretty sure I'm supposed to get it, like, next week or something like that. We were like, are you? And he was like, am I?
Yeah. Too late to take that back.
But I guess he's the one that we can follow the schedule because he's still announced at the Paris Manga Sci-Fi Show, which is another convention, would be March 7 and 8. So...
Interesting. <Yeah. laughs> Well, my guess then would probably be like a table read where like the end of pre-production, them getting everybody back in the room. All that good stuff. So that's exciting. And the other piece of news that we have is we can officially say that Callum Turner is back as Theseus for FB3. And today, The date that we're recording, which is February 15th, if people were very intrigued, is his birthday. So happy birthday, Callum Turner.
Happy birthday.
We would sing, but first of all, he's not going to hear it, and nobody else wants to hear it.
True.
But that's really exciting. That confirms a little bit of our little headcanons that he would be joining the group full time, so to speak, and going on this adventure. You know, probably the loss, or was it really lost? Because I still think Leeta is alive. The loss of Leeta probably brought him and Newt back together. So it'll be nice to have more Theseus around because I think we can all agree we really enjoyed his character and he was not exactly what we were expecting, but in the best way possible.
Yeah, we love him.
Yes.
Yeah.
We love you, Callum Turner.
Theseus is definitely going to be a like proper part now of the films. Compared to other people who just kind of don't feel like they should be there.
But, yeah. I wonder what would be his relationship with the other character, which them he... Because he only interacted with Newt and Leeta, of course, but he didn't interact with Jacob, I think, or even...
With the Americans.
Yeah. So, no, I hope that... Yeah, everything.
Well, you know, there's nothing quite like a trip to Brazil to bring a group of people together. Nice way to break the ice. And that is all we've got. That's all we've got. But hey, stay tuned for our next episode because if filming or a table read is truly happening, maybe we'll get some social posts and people will get all excited and we'll learn more.
I'm looking forward to be in that stage again where we just, every little thing that we get, we'll just be like this. And then we're obviously all wrong anyway, but hey, it's fun.
Yeah, we'll be back to grasping at straws.
Yeah, the Phoenix Register will get a lot longer as things come out.
Thank you, Phoenix. Thank you, Register.
Hello, owls.
Hello, owls.
Another bird.
We're all about birds. We actually got a very, very long letter this time from Max, who I assume is German. So hello from Germany to Germany in my case. So I've shortened it a bit, just to fit it into this episode. But Max sent us an owl regarding the discussion of last episode, which was episode 106, where they discussed the continuity errors of the Fantastic Beasts films. So, he says, "All right, let's talk McGonagall. You mentioned trying to make sense of her appearance, and while I'm still not happy about it, I stumbled upon a Reddit post by u/appsmolders, maybe that's how you say it, which makes as much sense about the timeline as it can, given the circumstances." So this Reddit post essentially says that McGonagall worked at Hogwarts for 39 years, but not consecutively. And he says, "I'm still not sold on her appearance. In fact, it greatly annoys me, but it's all we got." He continues to say, "That leads me to your podcast question for this episode. I'm pretty pissed about the continuity errors, mainly because J.K. Rowling knows her audience and fans and by now should really know better, but also because she tends to pride herself in how much backstory she has for anything and everyone. I gotta admit, I blame mostly her for things that went wrong in Crimes of Grindelwald. And after her queer fiasco, I'm even feeling good about it. The one which makes me angriest is probably even McGonagall. As mentioned in J.K. Rowling, is usually good with her backstory. So that feels super insulting and it feels like it was done purely as a fan service. Do all the fan service you want, but do it in the form of more Beast, thanks. The Niffler babies were pure fan service too, but that's the kind of fan service I expect in a Fantastic Beasts movie. It's in the imitates your bleeping sound ing title. The other reason that she can't get anything right when it comes to numbers, as countless examples, Hogwarts unit numbers, visiting economy, so she should have known to double check with her existing stuff and also have someone else take a look as if it makes any sense. So what do you guys think?"
I really enjoy the "it's in the bleep title."
The bleeping title.
I also like the, we don't like fan service, but we love Baby Niffler fan service.
It's so you know, true. Max, you got us. I'm putting my hands up. I've been caught.
I mean, it's no secret that this podcast is definitely all about more Beasts and yes, less Grindelwald story.
Okay, I'm on the team, I don't care. And no, really, I listening to the last episode, I thought that, okay, last time I'm on, I need the responsibility to represent the team of the people who are not annoyed by this kind of details. And I think, okay, I totally agree with everything that was said in the last episode and in his comment, but I think this kind of discussion is detrimental of what we can really talk about with this movie and the themes and in the stories, and the details didn't damage the story for me personally, and I hope I'm not the only one. But yeah, the first time I saw the movie, I obviously was I noted some problem in the continuity, and the biggest problem was the revelation at the end. And I remember in the cinema I was counting the years in my head between the death of the mother of Albus' mother, and it didn't match with the age of Credence. But that's the kind of headaches that I accept, because I hope that in the next movie we will have answers. But for the rest, I don't care. Sorry.
Okay. I think the counter argument is that we as readers of Harry Potter just expect there to be a way for us to figure things out and make sense. So it's really hard to discuss and theorize if now things that we would normally take as facts. We can't take as facts because she just might change things now that we supposedly had as facts before.
Yeah, I feel like I'm kind of with Marjolaine, where I do get frustrated by some of the things, but then at the same time I'm like, you know what, this is only the second film. Like, I need to see more to know where this is going, if maybe this will make sense. Maybe there's a reason. If there's not a reason, then that's just irritating. But I don't know. I kind of feel like I don't know enough at this point to be, like, truly outraged.
I can't wait. I want to know.
Just to clarify, I'm solely talking about the McGonagall thing at the moment. I'm not talking about the Credence Aurelius thing, because that is obviously a plot point that's still going to evolve.
Yeah.
We can't know a thing. But McGonagall, we thought we knew, and now we maybe don't.
Yeah, but again, I really think the McGonagall case is not a problem for the enjoyment of the story. First, because when you read Harry Potter, and if you stick to the canon of the books, we don't know really the age of McGonagall. And when you pick just one sentence, when she says, I teach in Hogwarts since how many years? Okay, but you are not supposed to know anything more, and it doesn't matter. You only know that she has a special friendship with Dumbledore. And actually, I'm interested to see in future movie if they use the characters of McGonagall, if she will have something to do not with Grindelwald, but as a friend for Dumbledore. It would be interesting to see that, and it will add something else to the story that we know, and her age, or who is not even mentioned in the books. That's not a big problem for me, and the Pottermore fact that they added a date, I don't think that's J.K. Rowling who chose the date that was on Pottermore. It was before Pottermore. It was it was calculated by other site based on the date that we have on the books. So yeah,
I think the problem is that J.K. Rowling actually did release the backstory of McGonagall.
Yeah,
and it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, but again, you can choose to consider what was released on Pottermore and as the same canon as the book, the movies, etc. I think that we can consider separated canon that are not polluting each other and enjoying the story of each canon and how they can resonate with the other. But again, that's my really relatively... relative opinion about canon and
You bring up an interesting point, though, because there are a lot of massive Harry Potter fans who didn't necessarily get into all the stuff that was released on Pottermore, so may not have ever even read that. So to them, they're like, you know, that they don't really care about this whole debate because they never read that information. So it's kind of an odd circumstance.
Yeah.
I suppose my counter argument to that would be that for the first film, there was whole stuff released on Pottermore that was kind of relevant. So,
sure.
I mean, I know where you're getting from. It's really not that important to talk about McGonagall that much because I doubt she'll play that big of a role. But I think for me, it just comes back to like, how am I supposed to theorize what's going to happen if apparently the facts that I thought I had don't apply anymore?
It depends on
what else can change just to fit the story now.
Yeah, but it depends of what kind of theorizing we are talking about, because I don't think the timeline and the continuity in the timeline are relevant to theorize about the theme and the character grow of the characters' stories of the main characters, for now at least, because like you said, McGonagall is not in the heart of the plot line for now. So, but yeah. But yeah, I felt that I needed to represent the the people who are not bothered by this kind of debate. But I respect the discussion still, but yeah.
Well, thank you, Max, for your outpost.
Yeah, thank you.
I think we're ready to go into this really exciting main discussion.
Yes.
Okay. Talk about being nitpicky and going at details. just know before we get into this, you are all spared my 6-page version of this. This is more condensed. I apologize in advance. So, we are going to be talking about the cinematography in Crimes of Grindelwald. This is something I've been wanting to talk about for ages, but just needed to sit down and watch the film and take extensive notes. So basically, we're going to look at how the construct of the film, the lighting, camera angles, etc., drive the story, and what techniques are used to get us to feel what we feel when we watch it. So just a little bit about the Fantastic Beasts cinematographer. It is the same cinematographer for the series. I'm assuming he's taking on the third film as well. He did the first two. And that is Felipe, I'm going to butcher this name. Marjolaine, will you please say it for me?
So, a bit of French pride here. So his name is Philippe Rousselot.
So it's like not even like an R sound. What? This is crazy.
Why not? It's just... I don't know. I'm sitting here trying to think of an English word that sounds similar to break it down for you, but my mind is blanking. So.
Okay, well, I'm just going to say it, Philippe Rousselot.
Yeah,
that's correct.
Is that close enough? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, there we go. So Philippe Rousselot is the cinematographer for the Fantastic Beasts series. And Marjolaine put in the doc, hashtag French pride. So just a few titles he's worked on before we get into actually looking at Crimes of Grindelwald. He's actually won a lot of awards, and I hadn't realized I'm familiar with a lot of the films that he's worked on, too. He won the 1992 Academy Award for Best Cinematography for A River Runs Through It, which is a beautiful film, if you've ever seen it. He won Best Cinematography for Interview with the Vampire at both the BAFTAs and the BSC Awards. And the list keeps going. So more award winners and nominated films include Henry and June, Diva, Hope and Glory, Dangerous Liaisons, Therese, and Queen Margot. He also worked on Guy Ritchie's Sherlock Holmes films. And he also worked with Johnny Depp before with Tim Burton's 2005 version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. He has also worked on other Burton films like Planet of the Apes and Big Fish. So a lot of actually big name films in there.
Yeah.
Guess that just shows how little we, and I say we as in people who don't care about that sort of stuff, know about people who work in cinematography. I shouldn't say I don't care about it. Yeah. I do care about it. I just don't know a lot about it.
Yeah, we don't know their names. Yeah.
I think it's interesting because a lot of people attribute things that are really probably the cinematographer's decision to the director, where in reality the two work in a partnership and a lot more of like the visual elements tend to be the cinematographer. So with a lot of these films, you may have known the director's name, but not necessarily known of Philippe Rousselot. I feel like my pronunciation gets worse every time I say it.
No, it's good. It's still good.
We'll just roll with it. So his style that he's kind of known for is making things look very much like a photograph, but like a life photograph. So it looks very like postcard-esque in lighting and color and framing. which I feel like we see a lot of this in Fantastic Beasts. Just the opening of the first Fantastic Beasts film with the Statue of Liberty, Newt on the boat, the colors, and just the way everything is positioned and lit is very, like, vintage postcard.
I have a question if that is also... this is also reflected in how we are introduced to Hogwarts in Crimes of Grindelwald?
Yeah.
Would that also... Yeah, okay.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, there's, like, so many examples. Like, I feel like these were ones that I thought of, but, I mean, with the 20s and 30s, too, that these films are set in, I feel like that really lends itself to his style and his wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Because those are, like, one of the best things about the movies, I think. Those kind of...
Oh, yeah.
They really kind of set the feeling of the film.
Yeah, I always say that the... My favorite shot of maybe every movie in the franchise is the shot at the end of Hogwarts in the second movie, Hogwarts with the bridge and the sunset or yeah. Sunrise, maybe more sunrise. Yeah, I love this shot. Yeah,
so pretty.
Yeah. Also the one with Norman God in Austria.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I just love snowy mountains.
All right. So diving right into Crimes of Grindelwald, I figured I'd kind of break this up into different elements. And then there's a couple scenes that I thought were interesting in particular to break down the scene itself. So... obviously, a huge part of cinematography is use of camera angles. One of those types of angles is the high-low angles and how you shoot a character, like from what height perspective. And a lot of times this can illustrate a power dynamic within a scene and between characters, which this is used actually a lot. Like once I started watching the film over again with this in mind, with Grindelwald's escape and that whole carriage struggle scene within the carriage itself, there's a lot of this going on where at the beginning Spielman is shot with an upward camera angle, so it's like we're looking up at him, so he looks like he's like elevated and like tall and powerful, he's the one in power. But instead of traditionally in this situation the other character would have the camera pointed down at them so they look smaller and kind of below our eye level and diminished by that angle. But in this scene, I thought was really interesting. Grindelwald is not shot from the downward angle. He's actually straight on. So he's not really below Spielman. And that's kind of like our first hint of... yeah, this isn't really the power situation that Spielman thinks it is. He's not in control here.
So, another question.
Yeah.
So, are you saying that the cinematography reflects Spielman thinking he's in charge and then kind of reflecting Grindelwald knowing that they're on equal footing at least?
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of how I read that whole little scene. And that's kind of... because it's before Grindelwald transforms into Abernathy, which then turns the whole thing around, which then you realize Grindelwald was never really a captive in the carriage. He was always outside it. And
so foreshadowing as well, since they were shooting.
So Spielman, in the beginning of the scene, is the one like in power with the upward angle. Yeah, and then it's interesting, by the end of the scene, it actually flip-flops, and you get this shot of Grindelwald looking in through the carriage door when Spielman's trapped, and that shot of Grindelwald is actually looking up at him. So it's like he's looming on the outside of the carriage looking down at Spielman, and we see that he's actually the one who is in charge of this whole situation.
Wow. So I
feel like I've been watching movies wrong for years.
So I was wondering, because you told us earlier that maybe we don't recognize the... What is the responsibility of the cinematographer beside the director? I mean, the director choose what to film and the cinematographer how to film, or maybe the director can tell the cinematographer, okay, here I want to have this feeling, and so I want to show that Grindelwald is in power, and there is a power dynamic here. So
yeah, so it's kind of interesting, and it's very collaborative in the way the two roles kind of work together, because they do have to have this conversation of, like, the director can say, you know, this is what I envision, but it's the cinematographer who actually brings that to life and might have other ideas of how to get the director's vision translated visually. So it's very much a partnership, with the two kind of sharing the ideas back and forth. But it's the cinematographer who actually brings the visual element and is actually in charge of making it a reality.
Okay, that's cool.
So just another instance I also saw of this upward, downward, high-low angle situation to show power. In the scene in Newt's apartment, after Queenie and Jacob arrive and they're all sitting around the table eating, it's a similar situation where Queenie is shot as the person in power. The camera's looking up at her, and she's actually got this added element of she's standing while the other two are sitting. So it's even more so like she's dominating the scene right there. She's standing over Jacob. It's looking up at her. And then the camera actually follows her when she sits down. And by the end of the scene, like, everyone's on the same level. And Newt actually is elevated when he lifts the enchantment. So it's, again, that kind of, like, starting in one position and then shifting by the end of the scene and the situation.
Yeah.
It's really interesting because now that we're talking about it and I'm paying attention to it, I kind of see what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as you've already said, you, even if you're not paying attention, you don't know all of this, you still get the emotions across. Like, you still feel all of that in a way,
right? You may not know why, but it's like, yeah, these visual cues of kind of the subliminal, here's what you should be thinking in this situation.
Yeah, because in this scene Queenie is also acting like she is in control of Jacob, because she's feeding him and she's taking care of him. So we understand that with his gesture and his action, she is in control. But the way that it is shot, and I didn't notice that, but it accentuates the feeling that we have in his gesture. So yeah,
for sure. And Credence is actually a character that throughout the film, he's very often shown from a high angle looking down, kind of really beating in that message of he's downtrodden, he's inferior, he's looked down upon, type of thing.
Yeah, I think the only exception would be when he's with Nagini.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it's because he and Nagini are kind of, I suppose, friends in a way.
Yeah, yeah, and there's actually a lot of that too, was something I noticed, and this is pretty typical in a lot of films. When two characters that are friends are having a conversation, it's usually shot on eye level, so that we, the audience, also feel like we're part of that conversation. And we kind of get that, like, these are two people with mutual respect type of feeling. So like you said, Credence and Nagini, also Newt and Jacob have this a lot throughout.
I suppose with Newt and Jacob, this is even more interesting because Newt could be all high and mighty and powerful, considering Jacob is being dragged into a world where he can't really do anything because he can't do magic. So it's probably even more interesting to have that relationship on, like, eye level.
Yeah, definitely. So then just another thing, another common element, but one that Ruslo seems to use quite a bit with purpose, is wide shots, which are typically used to set the scene. So you kind of see what the setting is, the location, the placement of characters, and their dynamic, like, within the space. So he uses this a lot to show, like, the spatial relations between two characters. So we see this, like, there's a nice medium wide shot of Grindelwald and Rosier on the Paris street. So they're, like, in the center of the street, moving down the middle with, like, a purpose, kind of, like, really taking over that street space. And you can see Rosier is kind of trailing behind Grindelwald, like, following him, literally following him. So that's just another interesting way to kind of get that across to the audience of, yes, here is Grindelwald, here is his devote follower. And then another good wide shot example is Tina following the Circus Arcanus scene, and when they're packing up to leave town, she's shown in the middle of the empty street. So we get that she's on her own, working on her own, probably not even really sanctioned by Makuza. No backup. And then Kama is actually introduced into the scene in that shot by walking up behind her in the frame. So it's kind of used as, like, an introductory type thing to this other person who's interested in the same thing that she is in that situation.
Yeah, that's really cool that you pointed that, because I never realized how they managed to make us feel so clearly that Tina is along on this case, because she could not be. She could be on the... Yeah, she could have a team with her, but no, she's really alone in this case, following, trying to find Credence. So yeah, that's in the shot.
Is the introduction of Dumbledore on the roof also a wide shot, or is that something else?
I believe it is, actually. Huh. Yeah, because you see his back, right? And then it gets closer when he turns around and you see his face.
Yeah, very traumatic entrance.
But yeah. Elvis. He likes his drama.
Yeah, he does.
Let's meet on a rooftop.
He chose the roof of the cathedral, so yeah.
And I mean, he chose to exit via Phoenix in Order of the Phoenix. So.
He's got style. So then the opposite of wide shots is obviously the close-ups, which are mainly used to show character expression, which is a really good way to kind of move a story forward and connect us with a character. We get a lot of close-ups in these films of Leeta and Queenie in particular, which I guess they have some of the more emotional story arcs. But I noticed a lot of close-ups of their faces.
I was wondering if you can talk about this really weird scene between Newt and Leeta at the beginning of the movie with the very, very close-up. And I remember that I was pretty uncomfortable in the cinema looking at this scene, and because it was too close. And yeah, I guess that means something. But
yeah, I love that, because it is very uncomfortable. And I feel like that's kind of like putting on screen that discomfort you feel when you're in a conversation with someone and you just want a way out, but you're stuck there and they're in your face.
Yeah, it's like we are.
I feel for Newt.
Yeah, I think we are supposed to be in the in Newt's point of view in this scene, because I don't think Lita is as uncomfortable as Newt. So yeah, it's Newt who sees Lita too close to him because he's anxious and oh God, she's too close.
Yeah, which as the main protagonist, we're really seeing a lot of it from Newt's perspective. Really, the main four, we see quite a bit from their perspective, and it's sort of little things like that that are used to kind of clue us into their thoughts and the situation.
Cool. So I have a question, because I don't know where I read it, but I read it somewhere, people saying, and I'm sure that's just always the case, that like filming and cinema changes over like time and decades, but people complaining that nowadays a lot of stuff is filmed with too much close-ups. And I just wanted to ask you if there is a like point in that argument, or is that just people being dramatic?
There definitely are more close-ups in films now, modern filmmaking, than say like 40 or 50 years ago. There's a few reasons. Like, technology is a big one. They just look better now. Whereas before, things could get kind of grainy or whatever if you're like getting right in somebody's face. Now it just looks sharper, looks clearer. So let's use more. There's also kind of like a stylistic movement that's kind of going on right now. I don't know that there's a particular name for it or anything, but there's a lot of like extreme close-ups, which is like taking that close-up to the extra level and just going like way in. So there's a lot more of that recently. And then also there's just from the editing and technical like standpoint of the speed of films now, they're faster paced now than they used to be. If you watch like an older film, you'll see a lot of like static shots with the action happening within the shot, as opposed to cutting to different angles or anything like that. Now there's like more shots per minute in a film than there used to be. So
yeah,
naturally they're going to try and change it up and be like, well, I can't go back to a medium shot or a wide shot. We got to go in. We got to go close. Also, there's the reason of, because it is faster paced, the thought process is that it's easier for an audience member to understand and register like a still close shot of something to get the message and the point across, as opposed to giving them like a wider shot that's full of a lot of action and then cutting away from it super fast. It's just more of like a, how do we follow the storyline and what's happening on screen without losing people, but still having a good speed of cutting from thing to thing.
So essentially, it's not as big of an issue as people trying to make it out to be. Because it's just technology changes and there's different styles in film. So
okay. Yeah, I mean, I think with anything, it changes. I mean, in another 20 years, we could go back to the old way of, let's slow this down and let's just let things play out without so many cuts. But that's just kind of where we've ended up, because I feel like we're so used to fast-paced now in a lot of things in our lives that sort of translated into films too.
Yeah,
which makes sense, because I suppose films always reflect the time that they're made in as well. So
yeah,
even if they're about a different time period, they'll still reflect the time that they've been created in.
Right.
Yeah, it feels like now when you have a movie or film where the pace is lower, or you have more long shot, it is commented as, oh, that's a stylistic choice and it's more arty, or it's more, yeah, it's, so yeah, but it's just more the old ways. not maybe the critics are saying maybe that it's a solution too easy to make quick shot in a conversation, in a dialogue between the two characters talking with close-ups, and you can film that differently. I don't know. I don't know anything about cinema. But.
Yeah, no, I think it's kind of a balance of stylistic and technical reasons, definitely.
Okay. Cool.
And it's also just what we're used to, which is always a thing with humans.
Right.
And change is always hard.
So, also something that cinematographers often use to kind of get their message across is lighting. So I wanted to kind of talk about some things I noticed about how the different characters are lit throughout the film. Newt is often lit very brightly with like little to no shadows. You can always see his face. It's very even lighting, which is kind of like an indication of his honesty, I think. It's as if like shadows sometimes come to mean like there's something to hide or something with him. That's just not the case.
Can I say that lit brightly with little to no shadow just feels like a perfect definition of a Hufflepuff?
Yeah. Yes. He's like the little ray of sunshine.
Yes, exactly. When you see it, you can't help but smile and go, oh, that's nice.
Uh-huh. Yep.
When you say that, I always have the picture in my head from the first movie when we see him with Frank the Thunderbird and the glowing light on him. I always see this picture in my head.
Yeah. Kind of a good example early on, actually, in the film is when he's at his ministry hearing. There's like, I forget how many ministry officials across from him. I think it's like four. But they all have naturally occurring shadows on their faces like you would in a poorly lit room where this is set. But Newt, on the other side of the table, is like fully lit, like no shadow. His face is all lit. And I just thought that was a really interesting contrast, especially with the room in which he's sitting, because that is not natural.
Yeah. I read this part of your notes before I watched the movie again today, and when that scene came up, I was like, wow, I would have not realized this if I hadn't read your notes before, but that room is really dark and gloomy.
I noticed that, I remember, because I thought that it was to make us feel like Newt was in an interrogation room. I don't know how you say that, but you know, when you have the suspect brightly light with the direct light and the other one. I thought it was this more polar, or like he was the suspect in the crime scene, or I don't know.
Interesting.
So you mean
too.
Like a police control when they put the flashlight straight into your face and you'd be like, thank you, I see nothing.
Yeah, that's what...
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, it is very much like an interrogation. So Dumbledore is also pretty evenly lit. Even when he's wearing his hat down low, the shadows on his face are pretty minimal. So I kind of took this to mean like Newt trusts him, and so we as the audience should trust him. Like, here's this good guy, like he's not like super shadowy, he's also like very just lit and not like austere looking.
It's very interesting with a character like Dumbledore, because obviously a lot of, well, I suppose 90% of the other characters we don't know as well as we know Dumbledore, just because there's already 7 books that feature him. Mm-hmm. So we already know a lot more about him. And I suppose before the seventh book comes out, like disregarding Harry Potter and Deathly Hallows, people were pretty much, yeah, Dumbledore is like the leader of the light. Mm-hmm. And then only with the seventh book and the backstory of him, he becomes a more shady character.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. This is kind of, that's why I wonder if it's more, again, presenting it in the way that Newt perceives it. Because Newt very much trusts Dumbledore, whereas we as an audience who kind of know where he ends up and things he ends up doing down the road are maybe a little bit more suspicious of him, but it's more portraying Newt's view of him.
It might also just be because I don't think you'd really know this if you've just seen the Harry Potter films.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it's definitely mostly discussed in the books. So maybe it's for the people who have either not seen the Harry Potter films or and read the books or just seen the films. And Dumbledore is still kind of presented as this completely trustworthy good guy before the films maybe in the future, like the future films maybe show his darker side more.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember how the scene with the mirror is, well, how the light works in this scene. I don't remember because I'm almost expecting that the light on Dumbledore is different in this scene, but I don't know because I don't remember. But
interesting enough, I thought you could mostly see Grindelwald in the mirror scenes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's like he's definitely the center and Dumbledore's kind of more in the background of it.
Yeah, I noticed that too, because Dumbledore is shot like from the back a lot so that we can see Grindelwald in the mirror. And then there's like, even when we see Dumbledore's reflection, he's more faded out. So Grindelwald is a lot more prevalent in the mirror.
Yeah, and then the scene where there's a teenage Dumbledore and a teenage Grindelwald, the teenage Dumbledore is more to the side and only shown from the side, whereas the teenage Grindelwald is kind of shown straight on, and
We
really see his face and everything.
Yeah, it's because Dumbledore is losing himself behind the picture of his lover. Very dramatic. I love it.
If it's Dumbledore, dramatics.
So, in contrast to Dumbledore, which I had mentioned, like, even when his hat brim is down over his face, you can still see his face. On the other hand, Rosier, who also wears a lot of hats, those hats are actually used to create that shadow on her face. So it's like the way that they aim the light, they're actually accentuating the darkness that the brim puts across her face, which I thought was interesting. It's a lot more sinister.
Yeah. Especially since it's not big hats.
I feel like I maybe saw all of Rosier's face three times in that movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, when I think of the character, I mean, Poppy's got a beautiful face, so this is no disrespect to Poppy, but I just think, like, half hat, almost like Phantom, but hat.
Yeah. It's pretty intense. And that's definitely not all the cinematography. That's also Colleen Atwood.
And we love Colleen. But, like, also, Poppy, you rock that hat. You know how to wear a hat. Like, just like how Eddie Redmayne knows how to wear a coat, she knows how to wear a hat. But it works.
Yeah. Special skills, knows how to wear a hat.
Put it on the resume.
Yeah, Dumbledore and Rosier are two very sexy characters, but in two very different styles, so that's cool.
And then we talked about the teenage Grindelwald a bit in that mirror scene, but as far as adult Grindelwald goes, they don't really play around a lot with his lighting, which I guess I attribute probably more to the makeup and everything else that's going on him, like if they played around with lighting, it'd probably just be too much.
I mean, he's already so white. So.
Right, right. Yeah. The one time I did note down, though, was in the beginning of the film when he's in the Makusa cell. They do put the strip of light solely across his eyes, which it kind of has this cool effect of, like, shutting off the rest of his face. So it gives you that kind of, like, empty, emotionless feeling, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, because in this scene, it's only a mask. It's not Grindelwald.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah, so the light you could think of as an additional mask, because it looks like a mask, just like his eyes looking through, which is interesting. If you want to go more literal.
I love it. I'm feeling like I'm in the middle of a making of, and the making of movies are always my favorite things to watch, so
oh,
I'm so exciting. It's so exciting. Thank you for that.
Yeah. I'm the person who sits down and watches, like, all five discs of the five-disc DVD special edition.
Oh, yeah.
So Tina is also evenly lit, except for the first time that we see her on screen. So there's shadows and kind of contouring around her face when we see her creeping around that statue to get into the circus. Again, I felt like, just like that wide shot that told us she was working alone, I felt like this kind of feeling and the lighting and the shadows really got across that this was kind of, like, covert and, like, not totally
ministry signed off.
Exactly. Not totally on the up and up. And then Queenie, actually, this was really interesting to me, because I specifically was, like, watching for Queenie's character and how this was filmed. But the lighting throughout on Queenie is pretty bright. Like, they've muted her wardrobe down, but her hair and her face, like, always stands out in every scene. You can, like, really pick her out of the crowds from far away because of how bright her lighting is.
That's just Allison. She is just bright.
Yes, exactly. And it really doesn't change, and the shadows don't come in until the very last moment when she yells that "walk with me" line at Jacob. That's when you see, like, shadows on her face, under her eyes, like, the whole deal. So I thought that was really interesting that it, even, like, earlier on in the rally scene, she's still this brightly lit, like, kind of angelic-looking character. And it doesn't change until she, like, actually snaps, which was kind of cool.
Yeah, I think it's a really nice way for us to know that, yes, she's questioning and she's wondering, but everything she's questioning and she's wondering, she's doing it from, like, a pure of heart standpoint. It's nothing malicious. It's no, you know, there's no malicious intent in her thoughts or what she's wondering. And then, like you said, when she snaps is, and again, it's still not malicious, but it's that actual turnover of, if he won't come with me, then I have to show him. And I think that's so clever.
Yeah, and that's actually exactly what I, like, wrote down in my notes, too. I was like, is this supposed to show us that she's, like, good throughout the film? Like, she's not bad. She's not a bad person. She doesn't, like, align with evil, really. And then she's just kind of temporarily swayed by it and tempted in by it.
Wait, we see her at the very end again, but I don't remember.
Yeah,
the lighting, when she talks to Grindelwald about how, what Credence is thinking.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to her previous lighting. There's nothing, like, very intense with any shadows or anything. Yeah, I think we really only see her face up close in that scene, like, once or twice.
Yeah, and in this scene, like, again, she's not doing anything wrong. On the contrary, sure, she is with Grindelwald, but she is helping him to be gentle with Credence. So, sure, it's to manipulate him, but I think what she said, just, okay, I can sense that he needs help, he needs support, he needs to be, yeah, to have positivity around him and not stress, so...
Yeah. And then Leeta is really interesting to me. Like, in some scenes, like this, the bit we talked about earlier with all those close-ups, the conversation between her and Newt, she's well lit. It's like very warm, soft lighting. She looks like friendly and stuff. And then in other scenes, the light gets more harsh. So it's a harder light. I noticed this a lot when she was talking to Dumbledore in the classroom and like calling herself wicked and stuff like that. It was a very like intense, hard light on her face. And then when she's telling the story about what happened to Corvus, it changes again. It's not harsh, but it's also not that warm light that we see in the beginning. It's like a soft light, but darker. It's a little bit like dimmer, and it kind of, to me, gave off that sadness. And I feel like this is a lot of why viewers all ended up really sympathizing with her because of this way that this scene was presented and kind of some of these elements that make you feel like she's genuinely a good person, but she's like very sad and kind of a troubled character.
It's like what's going on in her brain is literally what you see. It matches the color and the light of what's going on. She's clouded in this darkness and sadness, but you know, and her own guilt, and it comes again back to the whole, like, it wasn't malicious, so she's still pure in a sense, which is why we're not getting that quote unquote evil angle to it. And I know that, right. I was gonna say, like, it just looked very sad, even though you had it written in the doc. I was thinking it before yeah. I even saw it. Just the For listening purposes, Amy has provided some wonderful examples throughout the film of just how the lighting has changed from character to character, and you can see that really bright, luminous side when she is speaking with Dumbledore versus when she's in the Lestrange mausoleum, and it's such a stark difference, but the difference is in her background and not necessarily her.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the mausoleum is a really, it's a depressing spot. For those who don't find mausoleums depressing, to each its own, but to me, I find it to be a depressing spot. It's sad. It's full of regret and, you know, looking back and wondering what you could have done better, whereas the lighting in the Hogwarts scene, as much as she might not want to admit it, it was a happier place for her because that is where she had Newt and she had her friendship and she had someone that wasn't judging her based on her last name. So it's very clever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Poor Leeta.
We love Leeta. So then there's just two scenes that I kind of picked out that I felt were really important in the film and that definitely brought about emotions for the audience, and I know we've talked a lot about extensively on past episodes, so kind of seeing what's behind that and why these scenes kind of resonated with us. The first one I picked out was Queenie alone on the street having that meltdown. So before we go into breaking it down, how did this scene make you guys feel? Like, as a viewer.
Bad.
Yeah, it definitely made me feel uncomfortable. And I think, and this is probably very not about cinematography, because I think the human reaction to seeing someone in that much pain is either to go help or to go away. But obviously, as you're sitting in a cinema or at home or wherever you're watching it, you can't, because that's what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. So it feels really weird to look at someone who's feeling so poorly. So
yeah.
But I'm sure there's a million reasons why I'm feeling this in the cinematography that I just don't realize.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just recognize immediately a panic attack. And and yeah, I actually, at the time that the movie came out, I had a lot of panic attack at this time. So on a personal level, I immediately recognized the symptom and the attitude. So I don't know about the cinematography, but it resonates pretty hard. But yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, Allison's acting was incredible in this scene, which elevates it so much. A few of the things technically that kind of went into that feeling, it has to do a lot with some of the things we've already discussed about the camera angles and things. It starts with this close-up of her face, and we can see in Allison's acting all the distress. And then it gets into this pattern of alternating between close-ups and wide shots, which is showing us kind of how alone she is, but on a crowded street. Like, the people around her are giving her this wide berth. Like, they're not really near her when we go out into the wide shot. And then it's interesting because we don't see the people near her until we get in, like, closer to her again, which it almost feels like they're showing us that people aren't, like, closing in on her personal space when we see the wide shot, but when we're, like, closer to her and in her space, it feels to her like they are.
I feel like I'm encroaching on her personal space.
Yeah.
I'd like to back up.
Yeah. Because then we get these kind of these shots where the camera almost has that handheld quality of it's going through the crowd and people's shoulders are like jostling by it and stuff, which is very much like going into her mind of that feeling of people rushing by you and the busyness, but you're like stuck and everything's kind of slowed down for you. Let's see. And there's also, there's this like high angle of her when she goes to sit down on the curb, again, kind of showing how small she is in this space and kind of the insignificance of this one person looking small, sitting on the curb. And then there's more of this camera moving through people that are coming like at it and rushing by it and the umbrellas and all that. And then we go back in of the close-up of Queenie really starting to break down. And at this point, Russolo puts us at eye level with Queenie, making this very much a personal sort of connection. We're not looking her in the eyes, but we're like right there with her in this moment. And then that's, of course, when we see Rosier approach and we see that umbrella from up above that shot, of it just kind of moving very calmly through the crowd. And then Rosier actually doesn't even come fully into frame. We don't really see that it's her until she crouches down to Queenie's level. And again, the lighting here, how the characters are lit. Queenie is all evenly lit, nice and bright. And then Vinda behind her is shadowy again, with the hat and the half face shadows and all this kind of, I don't know, even the positioning of her behind her gives this kind of weird vibe there.
It's an illustration of the darkness to come as it's literally coming over her and enveloping her. It's, you know, blocking out her light, so to speak.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite amazing that even in the worst of her anxiety, the face of Queenie is not in the dark. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting that even when she's in pain, she's not in the dark. So, yeah.
Which I think is an interesting difference, too, between her and Lita, now that I'm thinking about it. It's like, it's almost like Queenie is dealing with all these things, but isn't quite letting it take over her yet. Whereas Lita is kind of very much succumbed to all of the pain and the suffering that she's gone through and kind of letting it like dictate her life and her feeling.
Yeah. Lita tries to keep all of that contained, but in the same time, since she doesn't let it out, she can't let it go. Mm-hmm. And Queenie, when she start to feel bad, she breaks, but at the same time she let the emotion flow. So yeah, interesting.
Then the second scene that I picked out was Grindelwald's rally, which I know definitely kind of creeped us all out. So even like when Grindelwald first enters the room, we get that shot of him from the back and he's all in silhouette, kind of showing like this literal darkness of his character. But then he gets to the middle of the room and he's all brightly lit and very enticing and kind of like that beacon in the center of the room. And the camera actually, this was the first time I noticed this in this rewatch, but the camera moves with him while he's speaking. It's almost like it's like magnetically pulled along with him, which is really a lot like the effect his words are having, that magnetic force. And also, if you watch closely, you notice we're not actually at eye level with him. And it's a very interesting angle because at first it feels like we are. It feels like we're standing there face to face with him. But the camera is very slightly tipped up. And he's actually slightly above us as he's walking and we're following. So kind of, yeah. So after talking about that a little bit, what do you guys think that means? And like, how does that make you feel when you're watching this?
I suppose it comes down to him appealing to the people.
Mm-hmm.
While also very much being in charge.
Yeah.
He's the leader. He knows what's happening. He has the plan and people are supposed to follow him. But he knows he can't just demand power, so he's enticing people to follow him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see the manipulation, but at the same time, you can't escape. You are trapped. And I think this scene is amazing, and I felt very strongly about it the first time I saw it. But now that you describe all of the detail, it's even more powerful. That's amazing. But we feel like... Especially what you say about the movement of the camera and the fact that we are slightly looking up, you really feel like you are trapped, that you move when he decides that you move with his word, and that's that's terrifying, but that's really powerful.
And also a lot of the crowd shots and the shots of the Aurors surrounding the perimeter of the arena, or whatever you'd call it, they're all kind of shown from above looking down. So again, that same thing with the high-low angle, they're using it again right here, except it's a little bit more subtle in this scene, but it's very convincing. So those are kind of more of like the nitty-gritty bits, like that vary per scene, per second, per shot. but something that's kind of a little bit more overarching is the color use in the film, which I tried to look at what it looked like at the beginning as opposed to the end of the film. And some things I noticed was it starts off using warmer color temperatures. So like a little bit more like orangey and just like warm light, like an incandescent light bulb. Even in the ministry, even though there's some cooler colors like in the hearing meeting with that blue light that's coming from the center of the table, that basin, it's still got that warm temperature to it in the lighting, in the palette. Especially like in the hallways when Newt and Lita and Theseus are all talking. And it just kind of adds to that more friendly environment, I guess. Newt's apartment is like this too. It's got the warm lighting. His laboratories are like this. There's a lot of like sunlight in the spots with like the kelpie and stuff like that. So like orangish and goldish hues are usually used to get across like warmth, friendliness, sociability, all of that good stuff. More like warm and fuzzy feelings. And actually, I thought this was funny. They literally use gold dust in kind of a comic relief scene of Newt tracking Tina with the Niffler. Like,
yeah.
They literally put that like gold color in there of the gold associated with like warm and fuzzy and like lighthearted. Here's a bunch of it.
Yeah, that's like a filter that you put in. Okay, now you see it.
Yeah. The Hogwarts scenes all use this too, which like we talked about that scene with Lita and Dumbledore, that sort of color temperature is there too. But then things start to shift to cooler colors, and we ultimately end with the grand finale of that rally where blue is used very literally in the fire, which blue is usually used to convey isolation, cold, sadness, melancholy. And this scene with the blue fire literally is ripping apart relationships and creating isolation, and it's very chilling and like a lot of despair at the end.
But isn't Hermione's blue flame fire that she carries in a jar?
True.
Hermione's true. Evil, y'all.
I mean, she lit Snape on fire with it, so.
Yeah, about that, I think I remember that we know that at first they were thinking about black fire.
Mm.
Yeah, they changed it. It says black fire in the screenplay.
So what do you think that, how do you think it would change the, because I don't know how you lit a black fire.
Yeah.
How to light a black fire, I don't know. That's maybe what
it's
this...
It's visually very hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, that's maybe what they realized. They thought, yeah, that's cool, but okay, no.
Yeah. Maybe not. I feel like it would just look more like smoke.
Ah, yeah, of course, yeah.
And I mean, this is not the first time we have a ring of fire in the Wizarding World. Because
mm-hmm.
in the first Harry Potter film, Quirrell puts a ring of fire around the whole...
Yeah.
Mirror scene, so Harry can't escape.
Yeah.
Yeah, the blue one is almost like a divine fire or something, like when the followers are going through that, it's almost like they are, no, it's not almost, they are pledging their allegiance to Grindelwald, so there is a mystical part in this fire too. I don't know, mm-hmm. but...
Yeah, I think also because the first couple of people we see going through the fire, nothing happens. And we only see the bad qualities of the fire when Krall dies in it.
Yeah.
So for the first couple of scenes, you'd be like, oh, okay. So this fire is actually maybe not as bad as it is. And then you see how painfully Krall dies and you'd be like, ah.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah, and it's still light. It's it brings light, and that's what Grindelwald is trying to say to it. I'm not bringing, I'm bringing destruction, sure, but I'm also bringing light to the world. So, yeah, you can trust this fire. If you trust me, you can trust this fire.
Also, considering he only lights this ring of fire after the majority of the audience has left.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. he tells them to go spread the word, and then they all leave, and then he does the whole fire thing, doesn't he?
Yeah, but the acolytes are still here, because he is testing their loyalty with that too, so...
Yeah.
I'm not saying everyone's left, but like the regular fringe audience left.
Not the people that he needs to convince. Yeah. Everyone is,
So that is the end of my notes, because I don't think anyone wants a 5-hour episode.
Say that, because
but that's a good conclusion, I think, because that cold temperature, the coldness that we're kind of left with at the end, and then quite literally the coldness of the snowy hills with Nurmengard, I feel like that really sums up kind of where this film went, and kind of the technical aspects that got us there.
Okay, but we can't have this cold light in Brazil, I guess. We need to warm up a bit.
It's all gonna be green in Brazil. What does green stand for?
Envy.
Okay. And Avada Kedavra.
Yeah. Envy and death.
It's not great. Well, Amy, thank you so much.
Yeah.
That was Jinx. Amazing.
Thank you guys for letting me do this deep dive.
So, should we grab the time turner?
Yes.
Yes.
More time travel.
A few times should do it, love.
For the time turner, we will stay with French cinematography, but we will go back to the 20s and the 30s in France to meet one of the most well-known film director of this time, and for some people, he is also considered like one of the best director of all time, so yeah, a big deal. So yeah, we will meet Jean Renoir. So...
is it just me, or is Renoir also a painter?
Hey, yeah.
Good. Because I was like, are we talking about a painter? Oh, no. Apparently not.
So yeah, actually, Jean Renoir is the son of the painter, Pierre-Auguste Renoir. So yeah, the most well-known Renoir is, I think, the painter, but Jean Renoir is quite a big deal in cinema, so...
Interesting. Yeah. Artistic family.
Yeah. So yeah, the father was a painter, the second son Jean was a director, and his elder brother was an actor too, because of his little brother who forced him to play in his film. But
a family business.
Yeah. So first I found a fun fact connecting even more directly to our main discussion, because Philippe Rousselot started his career in cinema at the same time as Jean Renoir did his last movie. So it was the early 70s. Because yeah, Philippe Rousselot is quite old actually. Even he starts young, but yeah, still not the youngest of us. Jean Renoir is even older because he's born in 1894, so yeah.
Wow.
And so like I said, he's the second son of the painter Pierre-Auguste Renoir. And he fought during World War I and was badly injured in the leg. And I mentioned that because it was during his long recovery that he started to be passionate about cinema. And he said that he could watch more than 50 movies in a week during this time. And Chaplin was his favorite. He watched a lot of American movie, and it was the big debut of Chaplin around 1917 and 1919, I think. So, yeah. Hmm. And he wrote his first movie in 1921 in honor of his wife, who is Catherine Heisling. And this first movie is called Catherine. And I thought, oh, cool, it's the name he gave the name of his wife. But no, at the time, his wife was, her birth name is André Herschling. And actually, it's because she became an actress with this movie that she changed her name to Catherine Heisling. So, yeah.
Weird.
A bit weird. And even weirder, I think, it's that this Catherine Heisling was actually the father, I forgot his name, Pierre Auguste. So it was Pierre Auguste's last muse and model. So that's why they met.
Another family business.
His father was painting this gorgeous young redhead woman naked, and the son was here, and yeah, they fell in love.
Okay.
So yeah, and during all the 20s, or most of the 20s, Jean Renoir did a lot of. Almost 10, I think, 10 silent movies during the 20s, and almost all of them feature Catherine as the lead role. So, yeah, he almost did. At first, he was doing the movie to show everyone that his wife was beautiful. But the 30s came, and with that, a lot changes for Jean, and so he started to do sound film, and one of the first was La Chienne. So yeah, so La Chienne, in English I looked, and it was not translated in English, but one of the translation is, what is that? I don't remember. It's Life is a Bitch, something like that. So yeah, that's the
title. Amazing.
Of the movie. Love it.
So yeah, this movie marked a change in style. He moved from various impressionist and expressionist inspiration to realism. And in this movie, Catherine didn't get the lead role. So she left. And it was the end of the first marriage between them. So yeah.
Wow.
But soon after, Jean started living with his new true love, who was named Marguerite Houlet, who was his film editor, and she will edit all of his masterpieces of the 30s. So yeah, no regret for Catherine. but never get married, but Marguerite still took the name Renoir, so she's known as Marguerite Renoir, even if she was never married to Jean. Okay, I don't know that you can do that, but why not? And she was from the working class, a syndicalist daughter, and her brother was a communist activist. And she had a huge influence on Jean's film, which became more politically engaged to defend the working class, because Jean is more from the bourgeoisie. Yeah, he discovered that the working class has hard life, so he made film about that. And he made two absolute masterpieces at the end of the 30s. There is the La Grande Illusion, so the Grand Illusion, I guess, in 1937. So the pitch is, the story concerns class relationships among a small group of French officers who are prisoners of war during World War I and are plotting to escape. And it's a film to talk about the absurdity of war. And Orson Welles named La Grande Illusion as one of the two movies he would take him on an arc. So I don't know what. But I guess that's, yeah. And also the Empire magazine ranked it 35 in the 100 best films of world cinema. So yeah, one of the big deal again. I never saw it, but yeah. And the other masterpiece is La Règle du Jeu, The Rules of Game, in 1939. And the film depicts members of upper-class French society and their servants just before the beginning of World War II, showing their moral...
Callousness, yeah.
Yeah, on the eve of impending destruction. So, yeah. But it was a bit too real for the time, and the people were really angry. The war came, and so it was a big commercial failure. It was even banned during the wartime by French government for having an undesirable influence over the young. But it is considered now, again, as one of the greatest movies of all time, especially by directors and writers. It's a big inspiration for the Nouvelle Vague, aka the French New Wave, 20 years later. And François Truffaut quotes the rules of game as a cinephile's creed, the film of films. So, yeah. And I found a quote to talk again of cinematography and before Amy development, I had no idea what it was talking about, so maybe you will be able to explain it a bit more. But so Renoir and cinematographer Jean Bachelet made use of deep focus cinematography and long shots during which the camera is constantly moving, both sophisticated cinematic techniques in 1939. So now that I had your explanation, I think I know what they are talking about, but yeah, it resonates with what you're saying about Crimes of Grindelwald. That is fun.
Yeah, so kind of like what I was saying, the opposite of all of these close-up shots that we have now in modern film. So it sounds like he would have a very, very wide shot from a great distance away and then have the camera itself kind of moving with the action. Maybe. I haven't seen these films, so I need to watch them, but that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I guess so.
Deep focus would mean basically the depth of field of what is in focus within the shot. Kind of giving it like more depth and more layers.
Okay, yeah.
So a lot of wide angle lenses, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw during the research that everyone was expecting this movie because Renoir was really well known at the time and they were expecting something like The Grand Illusion 2 years before. And actually, it was a very expensive movie to make for the time. And yeah, when it came out, they realized that it's a movie talking about the shitty world that they were living in. So they say, yeah, nope, it's a war already. So yeah. So yeah, that's the end of the 30s and also the end of his relationship with Marguerite. because he fell in love with Dido Frère, a Brazilian writer who worked on The Rule of Game, and she will become his wife she will stay with him until the end this time. So yeah. So in 1940 he leaves France for the US and he worked there during all the 40s, and after he came back to France, but yeah, I wanted to stay focused on the 20s and the 30s, so yeah. That's Jean Renoir.
Interesting.
Wow.
So during the Crimes of Grindelwald, he was shooting a silent movie with his first wife.
Before she was slighted.
Yeah, so I think he is not a wizard, but yeah.
A wizard of film.
But he did the most French movie ever during the 30s. I didn't mention it, but he made a film called La Marseillaise, which is our anthem. And it was financed by the French Communist Party, I think, something like that. And yeah, it's a movie about, I know this one because we see it in museum every time we talk about the revolutionary, the French Revolution. So we see this movie because it's about the revolution and the creation of our national anthem. So yeah, that's the very patriotic movie, but also communist movie. So yeah. So yeah.
Well,
we can go back to our present.
Yes.
That was awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome. See, that was not that in depth, I guess. I just talk about his wives because I find it funny, but
but he finally found lasting love.
Yeah, Didou. Yeah. And a Brazilian, so again, there is a connection with Fantastic Beasts, I guess.
Yeah.
So that's it for this episode. Our podcast question is, what is your favorite scene in Crimes of Grindelwald in terms of how it was filmed? We'd love to hear from you, so drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets or send us an email to speakbeastie@gmail.com. And while you're on the internet, please feel free to leave us a review on iTunes. It helps us grow our show, make some more friends, and we really genuinely appreciate it.
And also while you're on the internet, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SpeakBeastie. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/SpeakBeastie. And we're also on Tumblr at speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com. And you can always support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/speakbeastie.
I'm Amy.
I'm Oreo.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Marjolaine.
Case closed.